I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflor.
And I'm Pam Bedour.
And we're back again for another adventure with Sherlock Holmes. We're reading through the memoirs of Sherlock Holmes, which was published in 1893. Today's tale, The Adventure of the Stockbroker's Clerk. This one is the 15th story that we've talked about. This is day 15 of our conversation. This is fantastic. In this one, a young clerk, Hall Pycroft, consults Holmes with his suspicions concerning a company that has offered him a well-paid job. Holmes, Watson, and Pycroft travel by train to Birmingham, where the job is initially to be based. And Pycroft explains that he was recently made redundant from a stockbroking house. He eventually secured a new post with another group of stockbrokers in Lombard Street, and then it all comes crashing down around him. This is a story of high finance, Chip.
Well, it could be high finance. I mean, Lombard Street, what can I say, Steve? We have a gentleman here who seems to be have gotten a job with a salary, once again, way beyond what would be normal, which should give you a suspicion right there. And then he's also been given a sort of a task to, he's going to take over Paris, it sounds like, and he needs to put together a call list for him to set this up. The background of this is railroads a little bit. So let's talk a little bit about railroads. Railroads began in 1825, so if this was written in 1893, we're looking at, what, about 70 years from the beginning of the railroad industry in Great Britain. And just to put it in American perspective, the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, the B&O, was February 28th of 1827. And I think that was from Baltimore to, at that time, Wheeling, Virginia, but it's Wheeling, West Virginia right now, the mountains of West Virginia, it sounds like. So when we're thinking about the railroad industry, we should be thinking about people like, current people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and Peter Thiel, these type of characters who are changing the landscape. So obviously, if you're going to be working, selling railroad stocks and things of that nature, you're looking at things that are risky, that are certainly game changers in life at the time. And even in the early 1900s, your area, if they said a train was going to come through your area's chance of being prosperous go up just tremendously, because you at that point could be one of those stops that basically you're connected to the world, the modern world at that time.
And I love that you mentioned that, Chip, because just as your town could become more prosperous, it could also welcome in more crime. And so a lot of these big railroad guys, they had detectives on retainer, just the same way that they had lawyers or accountants on retainer. And they had detectives who rode the railroads and were undercover, like figuring out what kinds of crimes were going on. They also had financial detectives working on the financial angle. So the rise of the railroad is very tied, especially in America, with the rise of the detective industry, not just the public police industry, but the private detective industry.
Now that is fascinating. Well, I mean, one of the things that I wanted to also mention, railroads were risky investments, and so they needed investors, and they went belly up all the time. And so you can think of something like J.P. Morgan. Yeah, that J.P. Morgan, he had to become an expert on railroad companies and, you know, how the cars and how to lay tracks and every facet of the railroad industry. And you also want to consider that there were no real standards at the time either. So if your railroad went belly up, you couldn't necessarily pick up your rails and move them to another line, because your trains and how you laid your track was your company's version of doing that. It wasn't necessarily another company could come in and immediately take over. I just wanted to also mention that people like Vanderbilt, who had made a ton of money doing steam engine and transport through waterways, they were selling their stock and that and their businesses there to move to the railroad industry. So even though Vanderbilt died in 1877, he certainly was a game changer and thought of the future of how this would work out. And I should probably, let's see, look at my notes, that in 1871, there was 45,000 miles of track in the U.S. By 1900, there was another 170,000 miles of track of railroad service. So it's over 200,000 miles. And if you can just think about how the road system after that sort of took over some of the transport across the United States, and even how the interstate system had even changed from that, you can see how our view of moving around has dramatically increased over the last, say, 250 years. Let's go ahead and get started on our story as I kind of give this information dump of some thoughts on the railroad industry.
You know how much I love an info dump, Chip. So this story involves a young man named Pycroft who gets a mysterious message from a stranger saying, "I have a business proposition for you." Now, this is not a Nigerian prince, but boy, does it feel like the same type of scam as we have today in email. We also get here a little bit of detail about Watson's medical practice here. There's a lot of finance in this story, Chip.
So he does. Holmes ends up showing up at Watson's place of business and asks Watson to join him. So Watson kind of hands over the keys to his neighbor, who also has a medical practice. Look, it looks like there's a little bit of a trade-off. If I've got to go on my adventure, you can take over my practice for the day or so. And, you know, I guess if he goes away, then Watson can take over this guy's practice.
And Sherlock is also able to deduce from Watson's slippers, of course, that Watson had a little bit of a cold the week before, which I love. And then this is actually the second time that Sherlock expresses that he should stop telling people how he arrives at his deductions. I love the quote. "I am afraid that I rather give myself away when I explain," said he. "Results without causes are much more impressive." I love that because it's very charming. But it's a hint, I think, of what Doyle thinks really makes these stories work, is that we get the puzzle. We get like Sherlock saying these outrageous things, you know, like, "Oh, I see you've had a cold last week." And Watson's like, "I'm perfectly well. How could you guess that?" "Oh, I can see by your slippers that you were sitting in a certain way close to your fireplace." And that's the part that we love, right? We love the explanation, even while Holmes thinks it's a bit of a problem for him, a bit off-putting. That's what we really love about these.
But what I think we really love is when we are a part of the puzzle, when we are trying to figure it out, when we're given time, we are given some of the clues and we use our brains to try to figure it out before Sherlock goes ahead and tells us the answer. I think that's what Doyle was trying to say with this, is Sherlock gives the answer way too quickly without involving the audience.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah.
This feels a lot like another version of the Red-Headed League. The same sort of story happening here. Is it a thing that happens in literature?
Well, as we were talking about this, I kept thinking of the writer for the Dallas Morning News who writes the financial column. And I think I read that he said there were, like, I don't know, 42 separate topics that he could write about. Well, he's made a career out of rewriting this same column, or these 42 columns, over and over and over and over and over, maybe with a little twist, maybe a little with a little bit different angle. But really, there's only so many topics. And I'm wondering if when you're writing things like detective fiction, when you're writing things like detective stories, that if there may be, I don't know, 10, 12 that they're available and they're the skeletons and you hang the meat on however you want to and give your special insights.
Well, and that's a question for genre fiction in general. So when you think about the big genre, detective fiction, science fiction, fantasy, romance, you do have those tropes that go with each genre, right? This sort of limited selection. But at the same time, you also have a lot of room for innovation. And so I think that's how, you know, genre fictions in general work, because you guys, we're now at like 170 years of detective fiction, and it remains one of the most popular genres out there. Think about all the detective TV shows, novels, graphic novels, short stories that people still totally love to read. And so you can sort of see the skeleton beneath, right? The structure of the stories. But boy, there's a lot of innovation in the different ways that those stories get told. So many of the stories even today go back to the 1890s, where Doyle is showing us a lot of those initial tropes.
But it still has to stay to that basic structure. I sometimes get very frustrated when storytellers want to break that structure because it's been done so many times. They feel like they want to innovate, and that just blows up in their face when they don't give us the structure that we're expecting. It's a tightrope between those two things.
One of the most popular ways to innovate the story, of course, is to not tell us the ending, right? And this is called postmodern detective fiction, and it's a whole other genre of stories that set out to be like a detective story, and then at the end, they don't solve it. Paul Auster's New York trilogy is my favorite of these. And readers either love it or hate it. And Steve, it sounds like you're the person who would hate not knowing what happens. I'm the person who loves that open ending where you end and they're like, unfortunately, this, like life itself, is a mystery that cannot be solved. And I'm like, yes, but there is a reader out there who hates that. So there's a whole genre that's based on that specific innovation that is now kind of a trope.
Nope. I need an ending. I need closure. If you're telling me a story,
me
a story and there's a beginning, a middle, and then you trail off and go get popcorn, no, that's not okay. That is not okay.
Which means, Steve, that you wouldn't like The Tiger King because the lady down in Orlando and her dead husband, or missing husband, you know, it has yet to be solved, Steve.
Good. Everybody's talking about The Tiger King. Good for you.
Oh, the Tiger King. Let me go back to the Red-Headed League, you guys, because you're exactly right that there's a huge connection, right? So let me ask you, why do you think the Red-Headed League is in a lot of people's top 10 Sherlock short story list, including yours? And like the Stockbroker's Clerk really isn't, even though it has the same structure. What do you think it is about this story that makes it not quite as successful as something like the Red-Headed League?
Well, yeah, I was thinking about it. You know, there's all those things you're talking about. There's disguises. There's sort of an absurd amount of work that's being requested. And the Red-Headed League, he's copying the Encyclopedia Britannica. And this one, he's being asked to put together a call list for Paris. It just seems to be a lot drier, just much more fact-like, and the mystery is not as mysterious.
I think that the missing piece of this is the humor. This is a dark story where the Red-Headed League was kind of silly. The idea of copying the Encyclopedia Britannica is a silly, ridiculous thing, as opposed to making a call list.
Yes, and I love that also when Sherlock, when the guy says, oh, I can't believe I wasted so much time. Sherlock was like, no, you've learned so many things that start with the letter A. And there's something so charming about that way of framing.
Charming is a great
exactly.
word.
You're saying that the suicide's not quite as charming, right? Or the attempted suicide.
Yeah, this is dark.
There is an attempted suicide in this story. I mean, and it happens so quickly in the story that it's startling. It is not that same charming.
And also, you don't have this huge hall filled with redheaded men, some in redheaded disguise, right? You know what I mean? That was such a wonderful detail about the Redheaded League. And there's really nothing similar to that. You're exactly right. The most compelling and unexpected detail isn't attempted suicide, which is obviously tremendously sad. You also have in this story, you have disguise, again, in a much more serious tone than the disguise of the Red-Headed League. How do you guys think disguise works in this story?
Well, that was interesting. He was looking at the gentleman's mouth and saw the gold tooth. And it became like the call center, but like both of them had similar situation.
Yeah, that was one of those details where we see somebody other than Sherlock Holmes noticing detail, observing instead of just seeing. And that really breaks the case. When this young man notices, this has to be the same guy because he's got this one tooth that is identical. And it couldn't be identical, even if they were brothers like they say that they were.
The fact that an amateur, just, you know, a stockbroker's clerk, can penetrate the disguise really means that it's not a very good disguise. Like, these disguises, sometimes they stand in for detective skills. So succeeding in a disguise is about being a great detective, but so too is seeing through the disguise. So like when Irene Adler sees through Sherlock Holmes's disguise, we know she's amazing. But when Hall Pycraft sees through this disguise, we know it's kind of a pathetic disguise. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's just not as successful. The crime itself just isn't as masterful as other crimes that we see throughout. And then, of course, the attempted suicide.
Yeah.
Super sad.
He runs into the back room. Oh, there's no exit out there. Oh, we need to go after him. They break down the door. What do they see? Oh, my goodness.
And I love the quote. He says, before he runs out of the room, he says, "And now I beg that you will go. For God's sake, leave me to myself." And like, wow, this guy is really emotionally unstable right now. And he's really in trouble. And they sit there for a minute. And then they hear the gurgling sound of this man trying to commit suicide. And that's just startling.
And yeah. It's also very quick. You know, it's just a matter of a couple of sentences. And that is in some ways a little bit, I don't know, unsatisfying too, that such a huge event is just so quickly dealt with.
I think that it goes to the hurried nature of this man's thought process right here. He is in danger. He sees himself as in danger and sees no way out other than the ultimate way out, because he read the newspaper and found out that his brother had been caught.
Yeah. And did you like that ending, Steve?
No, this is a terrible ending. This is one of the worst endings. This is not exactly the boat going down ending, but the whole crime was thwarted by a city police officer, and Holmes and Watson read about it in the newspaper after the bad guy tells them, to read the newspaper. That's dumb.
Steve.
Let's get Sherlock Holmes stories anymore.
Doyle had a word length he had to hit. He hit it and had to get out of it real quickly. There you go.
All right. You guys know I always try. So we can all agree this is not a strong story, right? This is one of the stories that we've read. Number 15, not hitting the stride. However, let me try to salvage something of the ending. I completely understand. Sherlock doesn't actually do that much in the story, right? It's a city police officer who figures out the crime. You're right. The bad guy tells them, read the story. But at the very end, the newspaper article ends that the police are trying to find the guy who Watson and Sherlock has just saved his life. So, well, we may save the police some little trouble in that direction, said Holmes, glancing at the haggard figure huddled up by the window. Human nature is a strange mixture, Watson. You see that even a villain and murderer can inspire such affection that his brother turns to suicide when he learns that his neck is forfeited. However, we have no choice as to our action. The doctor and I will remain on guard, Mr. Pycroft, if you will have the kindness to step out for the police. And so what Holmes is saying here, I think, is that even villains like these scammers, they're still like people worth thinking about. And don't forget, Holmes has often turned away from the police. And remember, like with the blue carbuncle, he said, well, I'm going to let this guy go because I think it'll just create a jailbird and he's going to be just fine. Why do you think he goes to the police, turns to the police in this case?
Because they solved the case for him.
This certainly was a real scam. There was an impersonated person going in to that gentleman's work. There were probably a lot more people impacted by this.
And I think that might go to what Sherlock thinks. If there's a lot of people involved, then, okay, now we have to turn to actual, you know, jurisdictions and actually going before a judge and having a trial instead of just being judge and jury like we have seen so many times in these stories.
This isn't just a person who saw an opportunity. This is a criminal syndicate that has to be stopped, right? And Holmes feels a little bit of regret, I think we could say, that, you know, these are brothers who are super close. I mean, the one guy sees his brother's been captured and says, there's nothing worth living for. They're very, very close. But
well, you have a really nice reading of that. I think that he's afraid of going to jail. I don't think that he's thinking that, oh, my brother's been caught. I can't live without my brother. You're being very nice to this character.
Well, I think Holmes is being nice to it. Even a villain, he says, even a villain and murderer can inspire such affection that his brother turns to suicide after he's been captured. So, wow. I mean, that's what Holmes says. I don't know. Holmes and I have a similarly optimistic view of human nature. Who knows? Maybe that's why I like these stories so much. There's something optimistic there in his view of human nature, don't you think?
You're a much nicer person than I am.
Oh, you're an optimist too, Stephen. You know it.
This has been great. This is not one of the best stories. This is not one of the top 15 stories that we've read. It's lower on the list of the 15 for sure, but it's great to have.
Steve, you know, I thought you were just saying that this is not one of the top 15 of the 15 stories. It didn't even count.
I'm not good at math, Pam.
But yeah, we're... we're putting it low down, but you guys, we've got some really good stories coming up in this collection, though. My very favorite story is still to come of all the home stories, and it's in the memoirs.
Oh, how awesome.
We'll keep an eye out for it. Tomorrow, we're going to read The Adventure of the Gloria Scott, so we look forward to that. I look forward to hearing from all of you out there. I hope you're all doing great. I hope this has been a fantastic couple of weeks of fun and enjoyment with your family in your home for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, going on 3 weeks now, and I hope that you're all doing great. Please send us your thoughts. Send us your ideas. What makes Sherlock Holmes the most popular detective ever? Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all of your artwork and feedback that we've been putting out there, and join us again tomorrow for our next adventure. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflaw.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
We'll see you in the future.
It was lovely.
And it just ends.